about today. Well, first, thanks for having me out here. It's great to be in Toronto, see everyone, all that. It wasn't so nice last week. You guys are lucky that you weren't here last week, and it was really cold and rainy. Now it's very nice. So what I want to talk about today is an alternative approach to the anti-ramanation conjecture, which is now a theorem. So for a long time, we called the anti-ramanation conjecture the ELC, and now that it's a theorem, you have to call it the ELT. But as Jeremy pointed out last week, if you call it the anti-ramanation classification, then you could continue to call it the ELC. So I think this is a very nice thing to do. So I want to talk about the ELC. So what is the ELC? So the ELC is a classification of finitely generated hyperbolic three manifolds. And the classifying objects are objects that lie on surfaces. So if you think about a three manifold, it has some hyperbolic structure on the interior of some compact manifold with boundary. And on the boundary, there are these end invariants. The hyperbolic structure is supposed to determine these end invariants. And these end invariants are supposed to determine the manifold. Okay, so to define these end invariants is a bit complicated, and I don't really want to do it. So our starting point will be a theorem of Minsky's, and hidden in that theorem will be somehow the definition of the end invariant. Okay, so what's the first thing I want to do? Well, the first thing I want to do is I want to restrict to the kind of manifolds I want to look at. I don't want to look at all, I'm not going to talk about all finitely generated hyperbolic three manifolds. I'm just going to look at a special case. So we'll restrict to hyperbolic three manifolds M, where pi 1 of M is equal to pi 1 of a surface. And if you want, you could think of it as being a closed surface that avoids some technical issues. Okay, and I also want to assume that M is what's called singly degenerate, and let's put in another word, and no cusps. So what does this mean? So what is the picture? Well, the picture is the following. So we have some three manifolds. Well, first of all, the first issue that one might worry about is we know that our three manifold has the fundamental group of a surface, and since it's hyperbolic, that means it's homotopy equivalent to a surface. But the first thing you want to know is what does that tell you about the topology of M? So let's get this out of the way. So in this for this case, we have tameness, and this is a theorem of Bonhomme, and it says that M is homeomorphic topologically to S cross R. So recently, Agel and Caligari-Gabay proved a stronger version of this tameness theorem, but in this setting, it goes back to Bonhomme. Okay, so our manifold is homeomorphic to S cross R. What does its geometry look like? Okay, so for one of these singly degenerate manifolds, what the geometry looks like is the following. Okay, so it's sort of a schematic picture. Okay, so we want to think of this as being S cross R, so the S's are supposed to be in the horizontal direction, and the R is in the vertical direction. And this manifold, so the convex core of M is infinite, is non-compact, but, so I'll use CC for convex core, but it's not equal to the whole manifold. So this is equivalent to the normal definition of singly degenerate. So what does this mean in terms of geometry? So this convex core is going to have one boundary component that's isomorphic, that's homeomorphic to the surface, and I'll think of that as the lower boundary component. But then the rest of the convex core, but above that surface, the convex core is going to take up the whole rest of the manifold. Now, in the complement of this convex core, sort of convexity, you take the surfaces that are equidistant from the boundary, and they foliate the complement, and they limit in Teichmuller space to some fixed conformal structure X. Now, the thing we want to understand is what happens as we go out the end here. Okay, well, this is where you need to define the end invariant. So, or the ending lamination in this case. So how do we define this ending lamination? Well, I don't want to do that. So there's some way of taking the geometry of this manifold, and instead of getting a conformal structure, you get some lamination on the surface, which I'll call lambda. And, okay, so however we get that lamination, here's the piece of information that we want to use. So this is called the a priori bounds theorem. We get the following. And this is due to Minsky. And, well, the version Minsky writes on is actually more specific than what I'm going to say here, but for our purposes, all we're going to need to know is that given any M with, so, end invariant, X and lambda, there exists a sequence of Pantz decompositions which are called PI, whose length is bounded in the manifold, such that the length of these Pantz decompositions is less than some constant. Okay, so there's this mysterious lamination, and this lamination tells us something about the geometry of the manifold. And what it tells us is that there's some fixed, these PI, they don't depend on the manifold, they only depend on these two end invariants. Really, they only depend on lambda. Okay, so the PI only depend on X and lambda. So you have any manifold that has conformal boundary X and any lamination lambda up top, then there's some family of Pantz decompositions that is bounded length. Oh, the B is independent of everything. Depends only on the genus. Depends only on the genus. Do they need to converge to lambda? They do converge to lambda, but that's sort of they do. They will converge to lambda, and they're forced to. I didn't say what lambda is, so it's sort of. What? Okay. That's a good point. Okay, it's a sequence, distinct. They're not all the same. Non-trivial sequence. Okay, so this is a very hard theorem. Okay, and this is going to be our jumping-off point. And I guess I should also say tomorrow, I believe it's tomorrow, Brian Bowditch is going to talk about another approach to the ending lamination classification, and I believe he'll also talk more about how you get such a priori bounds. So the point is, he tells you what these curves are. For our purposes, we don't care so much, but there's something called the hierarchy and so on, and you really know what these curves are. Okay. So what is the theorem that I want to prove? And I guess I should have done this earlier. This is, so the theorem that we want to talk about, and this is joint work with Jeff Brock, Richard Evans, and Juan Soto. So, how badly did I do it that time? Soto. I can never pronounce Juan's name. And what the theorem says is that, well, we can ignore all this. This tells us how the end invariant gets involved. But we can ignore all this and just assume that we have two manifolds that have the same sequence of Pantz decompositions of bounded length. So, assume M and M prime. And so I don't have to write this throughout the talk. I'm going to always assume that all of my manifolds have this X on one boundary component. Up here, different things may be happening, but down here, we always assume that we have this X. So I don't have to continue to write this. So assume M and M prime, So assume, I'm getting my quantifiers wrong. So assume there exists a sequence of distinct Hansch decompositions. Pi, whose length is bounded in these two different possibly different manifolds, such that the length of Pi is less than some bound B in M and the length in M prime is less than bounded in both manifolds. Then the conclusion is that M and M prime are isometric. Yes, always. There's always an X here. Always, every manifold that's going to show up today is going to have an X on the bottom. Okay, so what is the N-elimination classification? It says that if you have the same manifolds, if you have the same N-invariants, the manifolds should be equal. And okay, so we apply this theorem of Minsky, and we say if they have the same N-invariants, then the assumptions of this theorem hold, and therefore we apply this theorem to see that the two manifolds are equal. Okay, so this is what we're going to prove. So how does this proof work? Well, in the geometrically finite setting, the N-elimination classification has been known for a long time. Geometrically finite hyperbolic free manifolds are classified starting with the work of Alfors and Baer's, and there was a number of contributions after that. But so we take that as already known. That's a much relatively simpler problem. So how we're going to use that is in the following way. We're going to look at manifolds where all these curves Pi are cusps. So, sure. It could be any bound. Yeah, it could be any bound, but yeah, might as well be Minsky bound. Do they just have to be bound? Okay, so given a Pansch decomposition, P, there exists a unique hyperbolic manifold, which I'll call MP. And what this manifold, I'll first draw with all curves P cusps. And again, we're assuming that we have this conformal boundary X on the other side. So again, what's the picture of MP? Downstairs, we have this fixed conformal structure X. And then if we look at the rest of the manifold, if we try to realize the curves P as geodesics, they get, if we take some curve homotopic to P and we try to shrink it, it shoots off out to the top of the manifold. It's become a cusp. The curves P, all of them have become cusps. So there is a unique such manifold. All right, so how do you prove this theorem? Well, what is the point? The point is the following. If we have the situation where we have this sequence of distinct Pansch decompositions of bounded length, then what we want to show is that these cusp manifolds converge to our original manifold. So M, I don't want to rewrite everything, M is a manifold where all the PIs have bounded length, and then we take the corresponding cusp manifolds, and what we want to prove is that these cusp manifolds converge to M. Okay, so this plus this uniqueness fact implies the original theorem. Because we take these two manifolds, M and M prime, they're both going to be the limit of this sequence of cusp manifolds. And the sequence of cusp manifolds is unique. So if the both manifolds are the limit of the same sequence, they have to be the same. Okay, so... So maybe this is a good time to say some comments on this proof and how it relates to the original proof. So in the original proof, you construct a model manifold. And this model manifold, not only does it allow you to prove this anyway lamination classification, but it's also interesting of its own right. And we're not producing the model manifold, any sort of model manifold in this approach. Although there is some hope, I think, that you could do it at the end of the day. I guess the other thing to point out, so there are, besides the original proof of this theorem, so what is the original proof? The original theorem, it was done by work of Minsky and then work of Brock, Canary, and Minsky, and work of Minsky and Mazur. They all sort of fit together to prove this original theorem. It's quite a sizable piece of work. And as I said, this is sort of the starting point, and it's a hard theorem. I think, generally speaking, the difference is that the difference between this approach and the original approach is that we're replacing some very difficult geometric limit arguments where sort of the topology changes as you take the limit with some analytic estimates you get by using the theory of hyperbolic cone manifolds. So that's sort of So if you like understanding the analysis of hyperbolic cone manifolds and so on, then this is an easier way to do the theorem. If you like studying geometric limit arguments, then the original approach you'll like better. And what else should I say? So there's also some other approaches by Brian Bowditch will talk about tomorrow, and then there's Mary Reese also has an approach. And in the Bowditch and Reese theorem, you also produce some sort of model manifold. All right. Is there any other comments I want to make? There's sort of a special case of this theorem that was originally proved by Richard Evans, and that is if you assume not only do you have these pan sequences have bounded length, but their length actually goes to zero. So in that case, this theorem is a result of Evans, and that's actually, in some sense, the generic case. At the end of the day, most manifolds have this sequence of pan-sequence compositions where the length is limiting to zero. Okay, so it's the generic case, but it's certainly not everything. That doesn't always happen. All right. So how is this going to go? Okay, so why is it easier if the curves are short? So the reason it's easier if the curves are short is you can do a couple of constructions. So the first, I'm going to sort of draw a schematic picture. So we have this singly degenerate manifold M. Here, hang on. Okay, so let's just fix some pan-sequence composition. P and that has bounded length in M. Less than some constant. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to take these bounded length curves and we want to pinch into cusps. And there's sort of going to be a few different cases. So the easiest case is, so let's assume we have some curve gamma in P, and gamma is very short. So it not only is bounded length, it's very short. You're going to pick some epsilon, and it's less than that size epsilon. So then how can we go from having this short curve to having a cusp? So here's sort of a schematic picture. Okay, so here's our curve gamma. It's a very short curve in the 3-manifold. So what's the first thing we do? The first thing we do is a procedure called grafting. And again, I don't want to define what this is, but I'll tell you what the consequence is. So we do this procedure, and what's going to happen is we're going to get a new manifold, a new hyperbolic manifold. Unlike in the previous manifold, it's going to have a conformal structure in the bottom and a conformal structure in the top, which we'll call Y. This manifold below this curve gamma, some sort of color here, below gamma, this new manifold is going to be exactly the same as our original manifold. Spot on isometric. Okay, so it looks like a geometrically finite manifold. The lower half of it is isometric to the lower half of the original manifold. So something must have, something must have changed. Something bad has to happen for this to occur. And what that is the trade-off is that this curve gamma, the metric has now become singular. So we have a cone singularity. So we have a singularity at this geodesic. Now, this singularity is, it's singular. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's also not so bad. It's a very special kind of singularity. I didn't write it down, but it's a special kind of cone singularity, and this allows us to do some analysis on it. And this is where the analysis comes in. We can take this cone singularity and we can smooth it out. Okay? And in fact, using this sort of deformation theory of cone manifolds that Hodgson and Kirchhoff developed, not only can we smooth it out, but we can keep on. So it starts off, this cone angle is going to be 4 pi. We can keep decreasing to the cone angle is 0. And when that does, the curve disappears. So the second process I'll call drilling. And in this drilling, this curve gamma goes from being singular to not even being there. So now I'll put an X. So now we've changed the topology of the manifold. X may be a bad choice. Here. That's a good point. Oh. Is O a better? Yeah, that's better. Okay. Okay, so now the curve is gone. We'll fill it in. Put a little disk in there. So that disk isn't there. We've changed the topology of the manifold. All right, so. Okay, and when we do this, we can do this drilling in a very controlled way. We know, when we do this drilling, we can do it in such a way that this manifold, this middle manifold, and the drilled manifold, well, they're not going to be spot-on isometric like they were in step one, but they're going to be by Lipschitz close by some uniform amount. So if we look at what's happened in the first two steps, here things are isometric, and from here to here, they aren't isometric, but we can control how much things have changed. All right, now then we do one more step. Our next step is I'm going to take a cover associated to the lower half of this manifold. And I can color this. Okay, so I take this cover, so here, all right, we take a cover, and when we take this cover, well, when we've drilled out, this curve becomes a rank 2 cusp. When we take a cover, it becomes a rank 1 cusp. So we've cusped one of these curves. and which is what we wanted to do. And what happens when we take the cover? Well, now there's going to be, again, this lower half of the manifold is going to be isometric to the lower half of the to a big chunk of the cover. So if we put everything together, our manifold here looks a lot like our manifold here. Now we need to quantify all this, and there are various ways of doing it, but the basic point is as these curves, PI, as these sequences PI, as we go higher and higher in the sequence, the curves are going to get higher and higher in the manifold. And we're going to get more and more of this cuff manifold looking like this original manifold. Again, you need to quantify that if you want to prove this theorem. But this is the basic idea. So if all the curves in P were short, we could just repeat this over and over again until we got to this situation where the whole Pantz decomposition was cusped, where we had a maximal cusp. And this is exactly what Richard did in the original version of this theorem. And I should also say, I guess the idea this graphing and drilling were first used to give an alternative proof of something called the density conjecture to show that everything is the limit of geometrically finite manifolds. So I introduced this graphing instruction to study almost exactly the situation to prove this density conjecture for singly degenerate manifolds. And then with joint work with Jeff Brock, we sort of extended this to some more situations. And then in joint work with Juan, extended it to give the whole density conjecture. And I think of this project as sort of, well, hopefully finally I'll be done with this construction. And this is using these same kind of ideas, not to just do the density conjecture, but get this whole ending lamination classification. All right. So what do we do when the curve isn't short? Ah, yes. That's what I was going to say. So I was looking at my notes. That's what I would have said next. Okay. So what is the point of the curve being short? How does gamma short help? So there are two reasons. Okay, so we noted over here that our manifold is homeomorphic to a surface cross R. And this gives us a way of talking about a curve being unknotted. So you say a curve is unknotted in the manifold if it's isotopic to S cross 0. So when a curve is short, so if gamma is short, gamma, we have a result of Ottal, which says that gamma is unknotted, which means that gamma is isotopic onto S cross 0, any surface in the product structure. So this is important in doing the graphing construction. To do this graphing construction, you need this. And the second thing is that we have the Margulis lemma, which says that gamma has a large tubular neighborhood. It means exactly this. Yeah, this is equivalent. Gamma is unknotted if it's isotopic to S cross 0. Yeah, if it's short, then it's unknotted. That's right. Okay, so short curves are always unknotted, and they also have large tubular neighborhoods. So this first statement is necessary to do the grafting. The second statement is necessary to do the drilling. All All right, so what do we want to do? Well, what? Let's see, so what? I have the time. I could. We might not do much else, but what the heck? Okay, so what is this procedure? So if you're familiar with grafting in of complex projective structures, it's sort of a very similar to that. So the point is the following. You take a okay, so we take our three manifold, which we know is homeomorphic to S cross R, and we have some curve on it that is lying on S cross 0. Okay, so what the procedure is, we take the cover of the three manifold, the solid torus cover of the three manifold with core curve, this curve gamma. So I'll draw this. So if I take a disk and I cross with S1, I get a solid torus, and I can take this to be a cover of my three manifold by the cover of the three manifold where the curve gamma is the core curve of the solid torus. This generates some subgroup of the three manifold isomorphic to Z, and I'm just taking the cover corresponding to that Z subgroup. So then the procedure, this grafting procedure, is what I'm going to do is I'm going to take an annulus, I'm going to take my curve, and I'm going to cross it with a positive real to get an annulus in the three manifold, and then that annulus is going to lift to an annulus in this solid torus cover. This is where we're using it's unknotted. Okay. If it was knotted, then we wouldn't have an annulus down here. So then we cut here, and we cut here, and we graft in this solid torus. So that's a quick description of grafting. And then the point is we get, the manifold we get is singular where we've inserted this at this curve gamma. But the advantage is that it's become geometrically finite, and then we can apply the co-manifold machinery to it. Drilling. Yeah, so drilling, what is the point of drilling? So if you have a cone, so if you have a cone, if you make the cone angle get smaller and smaller, what happens? So we place ourselves on this cone at a spot where the circumference is, say, always 1. So what happens if we're sitting at this point and the cone angle gets smaller and smaller? Well, then in the end of the day, this point goes out to infinity, and we've changed our topology. So that's the process of drilling, except it's happening in one dimension higher. Right, and we're getting a uniform estimate of what happens when we do this. Yeah, it's only by Lipschitz away from the point where the bad stuff is happening. So this is, if you really want to see this, you can watch the movie Not Not, where they have this all animated. With cars, yeah. In fact, my introduction to hyperbolic geometry was when I was an undergrad, I went to the premiere of Not Not. I never knew it would have such an effect on me. Maybe I shouldn't have gone. Okay, so all right. So let's return to what do we do if the curve is bounded but not short? So So now we have some curve gamma in P, and the length of gamma is bounded, but it's bigger than, it's not really short. It's bigger than our epsilon, whatever our epsilon is. Okay, so now we don't have these two facts. We don't have this anodyness, and we don't have the Margulis lemma to tell us that we have a big tubular neighborhood. Okay, so how can we get around this? Well, we can lift to a cover. We can lift to a cover. So we can find a cover. There exists a cover, M prime, of M, such that, here, maybe I'll use hat. M hat of M, such that gamma has a homeomorphic lift, gamma hat, and, oh, there exists a finite degree, finite cover. So gamma has a homeomorphic lift, gamma hat, and gamma hat is unknotted with a large tubular neighborhood. And here large can be as large as you want. You give me any radius you want, and I can find a cover that has a tubular. I can find a cover where the curve has a neighborhood, a tubular neighborhood of that radius. So this follows from this is proved by subgroup separability, which is proved by Scott in this case, the surface. So the point here. How do you spell? This is due to Scott. We don't know anything about the degree of the cover. A priori, we don't know anything about the degree of the cover. So there's some finite cover, but it could have it could be an infinite finite number. Yeah, we don't know anything about how big that cover is. Okay, and that's going to be one of the things we want to control. The issues are actually this implies the large tubular neighborhood is how you get the anodyness. So this actually comes from, I first saw this in a paper of Funar and Gadgil, I think both of their names. I should write their names. There's some topological unknotted curve, and that unknotted curve is going to be some bounded distance from our geodesic. So we just lift to a neighborhood where we have a tubular neighborhood that engulfs that unknotted curve, and then they have to be at the top. Right, yeah. So this paper was doing they were generalizing Gabay's virtual homotopy hyperbolic paper. Okay. So we can find some cover, but this doesn't give us any uniformity. We want to do it in a uniform way. Okay, so how are we going to do that? So we want to bound the degree of this cover. Okay, so what's the idea? Well, the idea is that if we can bound the degree of this cover, then we just do this procedure in the cover. Okay. And if we bound the degree, then as we do it, you know, we have this infinite family of curves, but for each of them, we're going to have some boundary degree cover we're going to need to go to. So we're really only going to have a finite number of different covers that we're going to have to look at. And we just take the intersection of all of them, and we end up proving the theorem in that cover, which is good enough to prove the theorem downstairs. All right. So how do we bound the degree of the cover? So this is where we use a geometric limit argument here, but a fairly simple one. Okay. So what is the point? So let's assume. So there, again, there's going to be, even in this case when we have a bounded but not a short curve, there are going to again be two cases, and the first case is the following. So we have the following proposition. Let's see. So given two constants, epsilon and b, there exists. Okay, so there's going to be, there should be, if I were to write this down very precisely, lots and lots of constants. I'm not going to write them all down that precisely. So given some epsilon and b, there exists an r such that if gamma has an r neighborhood that is epsilon 6. So what does this mean? Our neighborhood is just what we always mean. I don't care that it's a tubular neighborhood. I just want to take all the points that are distance r from gamma, and I want them to be epsilon 6. I want the injectivity radius in those points to be bigger than epsilon. There's just an r. Then, so if gamma has this thick our neighborhood, there is a cover, m hat, of m, of uniformly bounded degree, and again here the point is this uniform bound only depends on epsilon and b, and I suppose the genus of the surface, such that gamma hat is unknotted and has a large tubular neighborhood. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so how do you prove a theorem like this? Well, what do? You say, let's say it's not true. Then there's a sequence of examples where you have R neighborhoods where R is going to infinity. You have epsilon thick neighborhoods of radius going to infinity. And you take a limit of these bad, and where this cover, where the size of this cover has to go to infinity. We know we can always find some cover, but perhaps we have this sequence of examples where the degree of the cover has to go to infinity. So we take this sequence of examples, and we take a geometric limit. Now, our geometric limit is going to be really nice because of this epsilon thickness. And it's going to be, again, a manifold homeomorphic to S cross R, and we can just say in that limit there's going to be some finite degree cover. And we pull that cover back, and we get a contradiction. So this type of argument is used in the, it's in this proof of the a priori bounds theorem. It's used all over the place in the other proof of the anti-lamination classification. What really gets tricky is when you want to take geometric limits and you don't have this kind of epsilon thickness assumption. Okay, so there's actually a bunch of other conditions that we also need to hold that maybe I will not spell out. But so let's look at how things are going to work now. So we have our original manifold M, and we have some curve gamma that has bounded length, and it has our neighborhood that's epsilon thick. Okay, so then we lift up to this cover. So here's M, and here's M hat. Okay, and now we can apply this grafting and drilling. Okay, so we graft, we drill, and we take the cover. Okay, so now we graft. So what happens when we graph? So we have our lift, we have x, so our surface x has lifted to some surface x hat, and we have some other surface up here, y hat. And we have a singular manifold. Okay, so now we can graph, and now we can drill. Okay, so this is all just like we did before. We still have this surface y hat up here and x hat down here. The problem that we need to worry about is that after this grafting procedure doesn't really respect the cover. It's not, this surface y hat is not necessarily going to conformally cover a surface downstairs. So this is again where we have to use the geometric limit argument. We need to see that this surface, y hat, is actually uniformly close to some surface that does cover. So that's sort of an important point. And then, yeah, let's see. It has to be appropriately symmetric. Yeah, I was going to go into this in more detail, but now I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do it in 6 minutes. Okay, so this is... So what's the point? So there's actually some variations to the way the argument works in this case. Instead of drilling to a cusp, we stop when we get to a smooth manifold and we pinch the curves up here. This is the basic idea in this case when you have the R thick neighborhood. Now, what happens if you don't have one of these thick neighborhoods? Okay, so what happens if you don't have one of these thick neighborhoods? Okay, so here's our curve gamma. It's bounded but not short. Nearby it, there's some other curve beta that is very short. So we can't apply this bounded geometry argument. Okay, if we take a limit, we'll get something awful. Well, what do we do instead? Instead, we replace... So in this case, now the length of gamma is less than b, and it's greater than epsilon, but there is a short curve nearby. Okay, so what are we going to do here? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to replace our pants decomposition with another pants decomposition. So we can, we'll find a pantheistic imposition P prime such that the length of P prime is bounded and P prime contains a short curve put the and in yet, and P and P prime are uniformly close in something called the Pants complex. Okay, so this is another, so you come up with this Pantheistic imposition P prime using another geometric limit argument. In this case, it's not quite a bounded geometry geometric limit argument, but it's still a geometric limit argument where the limit doesn't change topology in the end. And that's sort of the key thing that makes it easy to work with. Okay, so now what do you do? Well, instead of pinching P, we pinch P prime. And then the fact that these two things are close in the Pants complex gives us a way of moving from one to the other in some controlled amount. Let's just make one more point here. How do we put this all together? Well, the way we want to put this all together is we want to pinch one curve at a time. And what we're going to do is we're going to first pinch all the short curves. Okay, we pinch all the short curves, and then we apply all these statements to the subsurfaces that are left over after we've pinched all the short curves. And if on a subsurface we have this epsilon thick property, then we do case one. If we don't have this large epsilon thick neighborhood, then we do this case two and replace this piece of the Pants decomposition with some other Pants decomposition. And we just continue until we've pinched everything. It's sort of an inductive argument that works there. The other place that we need to be careful is we need a sort of stronger version of this subgroup separability, which you have to sort of reprove by hand, which is one of the things that I was going to talk about, but don't have time. All right, so I think that's a good place to stop.